All right, there we go. This is Mark Gibbons, and I'm in Twin Bridges, Montana. It's March 28th, 2013, and I'm interviewing Jack Waller about Ed Leahy. So, Jack, our second run, actually, we did dress rehearsal, so we're ready now. And where did your relationship begin with Ed, Jack?
It began, I found out last night in talking with Roger Dunsmore, it was actually 1991. I had moved to Rumsey, Montana, a little area outside of Phillipsburg, in 1989, and had just completed a master's degree in English and creative writing, and decided to retreat to a cabin in Montana to live the life of a poet. And in the process, I found out about a Copper Village art museum and cultural center in Anaconda. So I contacted them, and they told me about a new program originating in Billings called Tumble Words. And it was a program that brought poets to what were called underserved areas. And I was told that there was a showcase happening in Helena with a roster of poets to listen to and to make decisions about inviting them to Anaconda. And at that showcase in Helena, I heard several poets and was interested. I thought it was a great program. But then I was told, well, if you haven't heard Ed Leahy, he's the poet you should definitely listen to. So I checked the schedule, and there was a reading by Ed Leahy, and I went and... You know, it sounds trite to say it, but I was blown away. His voice, his speaking voice was so powerful, and the content of his poetry so impressive that I immediately knew this was a man and a poet I wanted to get to know, and definitely wanted to bring to Anaconda for the reading series. So it was that year that Roger Dunsmore and Ed Leahy came to Anaconda, and I didn't know Ed much at all, so I asked Roger if he would introduce Ed, and he gave a great introduction, and then Ed followed with probably the best poetry reading I've ever attended. And it's a mix not only of how he delivered his poems, but his ad-libs in between and the way he would put them in context. And such a gifted speaker. And by gifted, I mean it flowed. He didn't have, once he got going, the flow was truly amazing. So as a result of that, I found out more about Missoula and the literary scene there, and he invited me to come and attend some of the literary events in Missoula. And I was somewhat aware of Missoula because I had a friend who lived in Arlee. And so anyway, I made one of a trip there that became almost a routine for years of going to Missoula and spending the night with Ed, attending a poetry reading, and many times it was not Ed, there were other readers. But those evenings and the day following introduced me to Ed as the most gifted conversationalist I'd ever known. We could discuss poetry and life discuss our similarities, and I actually have in front of me now a list that I made this morning to some of the things that we shared, and that became almost kind of a pilgrimage for me to the literary Mecca that Missoula was considered to be, and it was also deeply fascinating to me that Ed, being in Missoula, was almost, as the biblical saying goes, a prophet without honor in his own country. And I thought it was remarkable that I know his background in Butte, and I learned about that. But he had a long history in Missoula with the university, and Dick Hugo, of course, and all the great moments and the really challenging times that he had there. As I learned more about those, I realized that we shared a common reaction to the Vietnam War. We approached it differently. Ed was very protest oriented and very public, very involved in the demonstrations and the things that eventually got him into trouble with the university. I had become a conscientious objector, and I was not given to public protest, and even though I was out in the Bay Area in California at the start of the Vietnam War and during my college time, we shared a reaction to the whole to the Vietnam War as the focus of it, but to government and a number of other things. I also found out that we shared a blue-collar family history. My father was a steel fabricator and a welder, and we had that history in common. We, looking at my list here, we definitely shared a life centered, as the poet Rilke advised. I more so then than in recent times, but we shared that concern for a life centered around poetry, especially around writing and written poetry and spoken poetry. And we came to consider each other brothers in the art. Right? We used that expression in our correspondence, and that's another really key part of my appreciation of Ed. In the boxes that I'll be sending with Mark to the archives in Missoula are, I don't know, countless letters. And he was a truly gifted correspondent. And that was pre-email days. Later in our relationship, he tried email a little bit, but it didn't work for him. And he just wrote so fluently, and he was truly a correspondent. It was a dialogue through the mail. And a lot of it focused on poetry. A lot of it focused on the life I was living at that time, that he, I think, he had an appreciation that poetry is more than just writing. It's more than just language. It's the life of a maker. And we shared an interest in the outdoors, in nature walks. And when I was in Missoula, we would go to Reno Park and stroll along and chat about things. Or we'd go to Council Grove along the river and stroll and chat about things. And he had a focus on a life that I greatly admired. I tended to be more scattered than that, and he would comment, especially when we talked about poetry. He would talk about my writing practice and how it amazed him that I had so many scattered poems in progress, hundreds of them. Most of them are still unfinished. And it was hard for him to comprehend, because his practice was one poem at a time. He said, I focus on it, I write it, and I don't move on until it seems finished to me. He would go back at later sometimes to make slight revisions, but he was a one poem at a time writer. That was his approach. And we also, we shared an enjoyment of hot springs, especially, I'm trying to think of the one he liked so much.
Boulder?
Well, Boulder was one, but there was another one down south of Missoula, down...
Lolo
Hot Springs, yeah. Right. And we went to Sleeping Child Hot Springs, and all of those we would soak and chat, and he thoroughly enjoyed that. And then usually after that, actually every time we were together, we shared our taste for good Irish whiskey. That was a key part of our... I jokingly called them a two-man symposium. Our drinking parties, where we would we'd enjoy the whiskey and enjoy the conversation, and it was something that I think eventually became a problem for me as well as for Ed. The whiskey and
didn't he have a pretty good capacity?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
and that's generally what happens, is that, you know, if you have that kind of a capacity, eventually, when it catches up, it's like somebody turns a switch.
Yeah, the word I used for that is tolerance. His body had developed such a physical tolerance, and there were times where I would bring a bottle, and between the two of us, we'd finish it off. And I was going to add too that we shared an appreciation for fine women as well. And I tried this morning to find a copy of this poem, and I can't even remember who wrote it now. But the poem, I think I can find it, and I'd like to. The poem was entitled "The Sweaty Old Bull," and it's about it's a story of a chief who was given a young bride, and the poem is really very sensual. It's a beautiful story, but the sweaty old bull was a very old man. And the poem describes the young woman coming to his teepee and undressing and sliding under the buffalo robe while the chief sat and stared into the little teepee fire. And Ed loved that poem for its sensuality, but also because the way it ended is in... The young woman was very shy and very beautiful, and in the morning she awoke. And the sweaty old bull was still sitting there dead. And Ed loved that because I think to him... it spoke not only to the sensuality of it and the old bull's appreciation, but that was his last vision.
Yeah, right.
And one of the other things in my notes here that I really wanted to emphasize is that there were years, I would say, maybe 7-8 years with Ed that were really special, really valuable for all the reasons I'm talking about. And then there was a transition time brought on largely by alcohol and drugs and other factors where what I...
When you said drugs... Like
prescription medications.
Right.
Yeah. I never knew Ed to take any psychedelic drugs, but and I don't have a date on it when it really began to happen, but there were episodes where he would become deranged, literally, psychologically deranged, and made it really difficult to communicate. There were reports that came back to me of things that he had said about me and my life that were utter fabrications. It also happened to be a little scary because what he was claiming to know was definitely illegal, weren't true, but that caused a strain. And then there were other episodes where he got in trouble in his neighborhood, romantic fantasies that proved to be a problem with the law. And so that...
Could you elaborate and just explain what that...
Yeah, he lived in a neighborhood that had a supermarket down the road a ways, and he used to say he would toddle down to the market, and he became very infatuated with a clerk there, a young woman who was friendly, but he misconstrued her friendliness as being something that he would like to pursue. And so on one occasion he brought her an envelope with a key to his apartment and invited her to come use the key and come visit him at any time. And she was very alarmed, and she called the store security people, and that resulted in a ruckus. Ed didn't take kindly to authority, and especially policemen or other security guards or people like that. So
it does I mean, you know, just as an outside listener, and not necessarily involving Ed or anybody else, but it does sound to me that may have been a bit of an overreaction. I mean, you know, I would not perceive that exactly as a threat. It's something that you would want to note and let people know about and keep an eye on someone like that just in case, because that's not a normal thing. But it's not exactly what I call an overt sexual harassment by just offering a key to someone. You know, I mean, so I mean, I can see why he might be kind of agitated too. You know?
Well, and given his long history conflict with authority, and especially the years of his protest, and when he was arrested and confined in Warm Springs, and he was definitely predisposed on Ed's side. He was predisposed to overreact, and I think as soon as that security person showed up, that triggered something in Ed, like, what the fuck are you doing here? This is none of your business. I'm not doing anything, which then escalated. And
we also have the issues of what you're talking about, the mental sort of instability.
Yeah, the time where he was misdiagnosed, and you made mention of it last night, as having a Parkinson's syndrome, when it was really a manganese poisoning. Well, the prescription that the doctor gave him was absolutely wrong, and it caused all kinds of
prescription for the Parkinson's.
And it was totally inappropriate for what Ed actually had. And that led to a number of mental crises. And during that time, of course, I was living in Virginia City then. I was at a distance, but we would talk on the phone, and I would drive over as much as I could. And I was actually available to him a lot during that time. But it became clear to me that there was a deterioration physically as well. He began to he didn't want to go for walks anymore. He preferred to just sit in his apartment and smoke cigarettes, and depending on the time of day, drink beer, whiskey, or whatever. And then there came a time after years of my making the drive over to spend time with him in his apartments, his various apartments. He just decided that that didn't work for him anymore. And that was a surprise and a concern for me. But as his problems worsened, I also, and I've admitted, I felt that I was beginning to withdraw and abandon the friendship, and that's in fact what did happen. It didn't happen until I met my current wife, and my life changed drastically then. Even though she met Ed and liked him a lot, she felt he was a very tragic figure, and I think that was the first time that I had really ever started putting all the pieces of his personal tragedy, going back to his childhood and things that I had been so taken by his great poetic heart, as used Tennyson's phrase, that I overlooked a lot of what was happening. And then once I realized the tragedy of his life and how much of it was self-inflicted, that put our relationship in a different light as well. And I don't know if it's obstinacy or his grumpiness, his short-tempered began to dominate, basically. And I, even after the governor's award in 2008, we had enough of a relationship that Kristen, my wife, and our daughter Ruby, and I went to Helena and attended that, and then came to Missoula when there was a follow-up celebration at the museum there. And even at that point, I was concerned enough to interview him, do a tape-recorded interview. His reactions to winning the governor's award, his review of his work, his self-assessment, and that's when it really began. That's when it really finally settled in how much had been lost, because the questions I asked and the answers that he gave, and those are all in the tape recording, audio tapes in there. He was to use a cliche, a shadow of the Ed I had so admired, and of course by that time physically he was greatly deteriorated and slovenly in appearance, and I wasn't real pleased when Kristen and our daughter visited, and he was in boxer shorts with a gaping crotch and smoking cigarettes, and so that at that point I realized it was our lives had diverged so much that the best I could do would be maybe to put together some type of a tribute to him. And I was involved in with the Ellinghaus Arts and Humanities Center. Hadn't actually even formed yet, but I was involved with those people, and it suggested putting together an archive. And that's the materials that are going to Missoula now were originally gathered up to go in that archive. Because Ed, in addition to the times I spent with him in Missoula, he came a number of times to Phillipsburg, that area, Anaconda. He loved Virginia City and had a history there as a child and some great memories. And he made some friends there in Virginia City. And when we formed the Sanders Vanderbeck Center in 1998 or 99, Ed was one of the first people we invited to come there and read. And he actually he didn't want to, but it was part of the Committee for the Humanities requirement that he also do a workshop. And that was quite an experience because he did not like workshops. He didn't suffer the amateurs easily, and he didn't have an agenda for a workshop. And so it was basically just I think there were half a dozen people there, eight people maybe, and it ended up just being a conversation about poetry. And he warmed up to that, right. But it was a stretch to call it a workshop.
Right.
But his visits, especially to Virginia City, started when I was living in a teepee. And that's another connection with the Sweaty Old Bull story, right. Because he was very eager to hear any little tidbits I'd tell him about. The teepee was a chick magnet, and I wouldn't be saying this if Kristen were at this interview. But he loved to hear the stories of the various women who came, right. And spent the night at the teepee. And usually when he came, he'd give a reading, and he'd wander around town and chat with people, and he just thoroughly enjoyed it. That was back in the late 90s, early, maybe 2000, I don't remember. But as part of that process, that's also where I began to see how heavily he was drinking, because I had a couple bottles that I didn't have a lot of money, so I was kind of frugal in my drinking. Well, there was never a drop when Ed left. And I never complained about it, but it made it really clear to me that he wouldn't wait until we could have a drink together. If it was there, he would drink it. And those visits, I also really appreciated how much Ed enjoyed what I call the tree art that I make. And back then, he loved to get out into the woods, and he actually took a couple really good photos of me out with a very special tree. And I made him a cane that he used right up until the time he died, I think. But he had a poet's way of glamorizing what I was doing that made it a combination of a Tolkien and a character and a wizard and such. And I still, it was about a month ago, I guess, I came across his introduction to me at that Union Club. That was in 1996, I think.
96.
February 96, where you and I met.
Right.
And I had real misgivings about coming to Missoula and doing that, partly because of the literary status of the town and of the people who would be there, but also a self-consciousness because my writings were almost entirely about process. They weren't about product. And Ed was constantly urging me to finish, you know, finish. And so when I came to that, I use it in quotes, that reading at the Union Club, I told Ed, I said, all I can really do is share some of the fragments, share some of the stories, and some of my own sense of the poetic life.
Right.
And I remember, and just read about a month ago, his introduction, and I to this day really value that it wasn't about me being a polished literary poet, yeah, but just his admiration for the life and for the fact that writing was central to it, but in a very different way. And I think that was something that, given his love of the concrete world, the butte world, the mines, the world of the mines, or the world of nature, and just the concreteness of his poetry, he was not interested in great abstractions and flights of philosophy. And I remembered him at one time. I was telling him about my grandmother and her statement that in the Waller family there in England there was Edmund Waller, that famous "Go Lovely Rose." It's about all he's remembered for now. But there were. Colonel John Waller were both poet laureates of England, and my grandmother was convinced that they were direct ancestors, and she was into genealogy and that kind of thing. So I made a point of sharing that with Ed, and his response was blunt, and it was poet laureate, poet nauseate. And he had that tendency when there was pretension, whether it was intellectual, artistic, whatever, he didn't like it. And he had a feeling that the strength of his poetry was how rooted it is in the concrete world. Real places, real people, real activities. And it's not that he wouldn't venture an abstraction or anything. He would, but he got a letter from, what was it, Fiedler?
Leslie Fiedler,
complimenting him, Ed, on the fact that he had something real, mm-hmm, to write about.
Right.
And Ed, that just thrilled him because that was the strength of his writing. And I remember one time I played guitar for years and years and years, and Ed really enjoyed my guitar playing and folk singing, and including having his daughter and granddaughter over and have me serenade little Gracie when she was 5 years old, six maybe. And so at one point he mentioned putting one of his poems to music, and he has another good friend who eventually did that with another one of his poems, Jenny Feline. True to form, I never got around to doing it, but I picked the poem and started fiddling around with chord progressions and all that. I never felt ready to even demonstrate anything to Ed, but the poem I picked was Confederate Shacks. And that was always, to me, that was a motion picture. That was a drama, a story that to me showed how deep Ed could go while seemingly being just descriptive. Mm-hmm. And I loved that poem, and I told him I was working on doing it, and he was quite pleased with that. But once it became apparent, it wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, again, that was, I think, one of his, and I would say heartfelt concerns, that he felt I had real promise, but an inability to focus. I was just too scattered. And in fact, that's true.
Well, but to talk, add something to that whole point that you're making between yourself and Ed in an artistic level, I mean, a lot of the, I mean, he was driven to product. He was driven to completing things, like mm-hmm. you said, and because he really coveted that book, and he really coveted the recognition and the admiration that he never really got mm-hmm. enough of, mm-hmm. and I mean, I think those were things that were so strong that he, in a drive, yeah. that is why he was so his art mm-hmm. was so product sort of oriented, whereas there's just all kinds of, I mean, life is an artistic,
that's right.
creative journey, that's and right. that's, so that's what you're saying, is that you express that on a daily yeah. basis.
Yeah, and the other element with Ed that I in reviewing, just glancing through some of the letters this morning, right away I found it again. He had one way that he could make money, and that was through his writing. Mm-hmm. And that's what he saw. And I don't know how to characterize it. I think it was, you could call it ambition, but I think it had a higher motive than that. But he, especially when he went to work on the novels, he made a real point of saying, and quoted Dostoevsky, "Only the book can save me now," because Dostoevsky had gone into exile because he had creditors chasing him and all that. And he was in a real economic crisis, and Ed made that analogous to his own situation. And I think that was, he deeply considered himself a professional writer. And given that goal and given that sense of who he was, that made it really necessary for him to make products and to take them to the marketplace. And I remember even when he talked about the, I forget what, was it a fellowship or something that he got early on?
Mm-hmm. Minnesota.
Yeah, and how much that just thrilled him, how much that meant to him, right. to actually have money as a result of
money, and because I mean, you're going in, you know, from working class background,
right?
I mean, you know, money defines us in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It's the reality of our mm-hmm. existence, and so you yeah. measure your success mm-hmm. by money. And so he wanted that, and yeah. and of course, in that world, you've got that whole publish or perish mentality.
That's right.
So all of that was driven towards some kind of success mm-hmm. and
that's
being,
right.
you know, worthy of.
Yeah, yeah. I have a note here, and this is a perfect time to bring it in. One of the last things I did for Ed, at his request, was draft his last will, and with his daughters, and I'm not an attorney and I wasn't representing him, but I had the ability to do that as a gift to him, which I did, and which turned out to be executed and all that. But the reason that comes up now is that his, in bequeathing his assets, his top priority were his intellectual properties, his writings, the book, especially after Russ Chatham had published Birds of a Feather. And then he was very concerned that be acknowledged as his legacy, and that was set up. He had very few material possessions. He had very few assets at all. There were a few financial assets, and he was concerned about that. But in discussing that with him, it made it really clear that he looked back over a long life of, boy, it's a tough one to know because I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth, but of struggle, economic, interpersonal, political. I mean, his review of his life, especially at that time when we were working on his will, was a history of a lot of pain, a lot of... He used the word over and over and over again, how haunted he was by regrets. Regrets that things had happened way, way, way back. And I think that's part of the way I came to understand Ed's life in the big picture, is that the undercurrents that originated even in childhood that came up through... I remember him showing me a picture. I think it was... I don't know if it was a high school picture. I think it was. And him just looking at it and admiring it. And you could just tell. And he turned it around and pointed it at me, and he said, "I was goddamn good looking, wasn't I?"
And he had promise.
Oh yeah.
And he was a young intellectual. Mm-hmm. Way up. Well, you I think in the in the dress rehearsal for this interview, in the last go round, I think I recall you using the word genius.
Mm-hmm.
In referring to Ed.
Yeah, I think I do, and I think, what's the Ruthke? He loved that line in Ruthke. Gosh, it's about what is madness but genius at odds with circumstance. That's a paraphrase of it, but yeah. It's pretty close. He loved that.
Right.
And he felt that was a key part of understanding his life, is that he had been at odds.
Right.
And sometimes ventured into madness. Mm-hmm. In his circumstances. And
yeah, that's madness is stepping totally outside of the culture and what's right. appropriate, and so whether that's thrust upon you or self-inflicted or any of that doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is, if you go through that, you come out on the other side and you write about it. I mean, somehow you're operating from a different place. Mm-hmm. And what you bring back from that place, that is what yeah. your gift yeah. is to us going through the business of trying to mm-hmm. live together in this world.
That's right. And once again, that phrase, I might have already mentioned it earlier this session, but we talked a lot about what the Greeks called furor poeticus, a poetic madness. And And then there was also a, I think it was the Roman poet, Juvenal, had a saying, furor scribendi, a rage for writing. And I think in large part, from the very beginning, I felt that that was the Irish character, the Irish gene, the Irish blood, the ancestry, the everything. The more I listened to him and the more I put it all together, it his I remember talking with him and his sense of justice and his sense of indignation about the wrongs. And God, I remember one time he was telling me about the potato famine in Ireland and the horror of that. And God, he went into a rage just talking about that. And it was a little intimidating, you know, he's a big guy. And my father was English. Which was another reason, by the way, that it didn't impress Ed to talk about any poet laureate from England. He was not impressed with that. He liked the fact that my mother was full-blooded German. He was okay with that. But I think time, and I don't remember if it was at the Governor's Award, that I happened to sit with Pat Williams. And we talked about Butte and about Pat Williams and Ed and the bond that Butte gave them. And the more Pat Williams talked, the more I could see that Irish, that Butte, that hard scrabble, that all was there in Ed. And I think I mentioned too that years after I had met Ed, I heard a tape recording of W.B. Yeats. And I think Ed's a much, much better reader than Yeats. But Yeats had that same kind of oracular, you know, thing. I came from the Bay Area, and the poetry scene out there was, to me, it was a continuation. A lot of the poetry that happened there was, they even called it the language poets, and it was stuff that, to me, it was all up here, and it didn't have
Hargraves and
Berkeley
Renaissance and, sort of.
Yeah, and even I liked the confessional poets, that from Ruthke to Wright to Lowell to Platt. That was my area of interest. And when I would attend readings there in the Bay Area, they were almost lifeless. And by the way, I really enjoyed your final performance poem last night. That was very well done. But that's what part of the reason I was so blown away by Ed. Because to sit down and to have this very large figure, and he was in pretty good shape then,
right,
come up to the podium and just start. And it's like that commercial of the sound,
right,
sonic wave just blowing.
Right. Hair blowing back.
Yeah. And my first thought was, instantly I thought, is this guy for real?
The old man in the hospital bed with his thorny foot stuck between the red.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a first.
Yeah.
For me. And I'm trying to remember how it happened. I'm sure it happened right there, because there were people signing up. You know, I was there to represent the Copper Village Art Museum and Center or something like that. So I just went up, and the first name I wrote down is Ed Leahy. And then there were a couple. Oh, Lowell Yeager. I like Lowell Yeager. That's where I met Lowell. And there's one other I'm not remembering right now. But Ed was very different when, you know, when I just went away from the podium. Very interesting and all that, but I just thought, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're amazing. Yeah, that was right. That was really powerful. Right. And then I think following that, it wasn't that long afterwards that Roger Dunsmore and Ed came to the Copper Village and did that reading that I still consider the best I ever heard Ed give, and deeply regretted there was no tape recorder there for it. But it's...
Yeah, it's a shame, I think, that there aren't more tape recordings of him in the height of his power, because in the height of his power he was, you know, shiver me timbers kind of...
Yeah. I came to Missoula, it was in the early 90s, and he gave a reading, and I brought a tape recorder that malfunctioned. And it was recorded, but it was as if the tape was sloppy, and it would jump and it would skip, and you could hear a little, and I was really, really disappointed in that. I don't remember the exact...
The location?
Yeah, it was in, I think it was in the art museum, the one downtown.
Mm-hmm. The old Carnegie.
Yeah.
The old Carnegie Library. They turned into the art museum.
Right, yeah. I'm sure that's where it was. And I think Cheryl Nothe read with him that night. And by the way, I came across another tidbit in one of the letters, glanced through. He was bemoaning the fact that he was alone for the holidays, and he said, but I do have the good fortune of keeping company with a lovely young poet, Cheryl Nothe.
Yeah.
And then he had there was another artist writer who, boy, this is just coming back to my memory, who he had a brief affair with, very talented writer, and I'm trying to remember where, I think she lived in Missoula, but they would go down to Lolo Hot Springs together, and they had it was pretty lively there. I can't remember her name, but she was a very skilled writer. It wrote mostly short stories, and some Susan Barnes. There it is. That's what we've talked about.
Yeah.
Susan Barnes.
Yeah.
And he was very smitten with her, because I think of all the women he actually was intimate with, she more than any of them could match, and she was right there with him. And I think they even co-wrote some things and experimented with exchanging lines and stuff like that. And I think what happened is she had an ex who returned, and that ended, I think, Susan Barnes. Yeah, that someone could pursue that line. Because Ed was, I told him one time I had worked in a cannery out in Oakland, California, and I worked on the graveyard shift with this black man. And actually, it was not, it was the morning, 7 to 3 shift. And I worked with this black guy who, at that time, I was in my early 20s and he was in his mid-30s. And I told Ed this story, and And there were mornings where you could tell he came in and he'd been out all night, and you could smell it, you could everything. And the reason I'm telling this story is because Ed loved this line that the guy told me one day, and it stuck in my mind. I've tried for years to make a blues song out of it, but he said, "I loves the women's. I loves them, but they's killing me." And Ed howled at that one. He said, "Boy, I know." Because that was, if the word romantic applies to Ed, it certainly applies that way. I mean, he definitely had that. In a way, it was one of his biggest sources of difficulty as well.
Right. I don't know if you were aware. I discovered in, because there was something I was not aware of, and I talked to Hal Waldrop, and he informed me that that's why. I said, "Do you know exactly why Ed decided? You know, I mean, his mother had passed away. He had her place, and then he sold it, and he bought a house. He got married, and then that marriage dissolved. But he was in Butte, and do you know why he left Butte and went to Missoula?" And Hal told me. He said, "Yeah, he had to. He got into trouble by sort of harassing women, kind of like the supermarket story."
That's a new one for me.
I didn't know if you'd heard that, but that isn't. He'd been down that road before. Hmm.
There was a woman there, an artist. I don't think she did much writing. Once again, I can't remember her name. But he was quite taken with her. She lived up in one of the upper floors of a building there in Butte.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And she was a painter. And I think she was involved with dance and maybe some other things. This one is not going to pop into my head, I don't think. But she could well have been one of those mm-hmm. women who didn't take kindly to and I think part of that move to Missoula always did interest me, because I went back to Butte several times with Ed and James Dore Johnson. And we'd get together with some of those other people, and Ed's still seemed to have good connections there. I mean, and he gave several readings there that I went to, but I never really did understand the Missoula.
Why? Move. That,
yeah.
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 And so Hal kind of shed some light on that. It's a shame that did you hear about James Dore Johnson?
No.
Yeah, he passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, rather suddenly and unexpectedly. It was an embolism.
Hmm.
He had been to China with his wife, and they had a long flight and then a long drive, and it just happened.
Hmm.
So we lost a great source there for, you know,
yes.
information with
yes.
Ed, especially in the 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
or in Butte. But everything that James Dore Johnson had, he contributed to the archive in Butte. So there's also an archive in Butte.
I didn't know that.
So.
Yeah, it, for what I have, I think the Missoula archive is much more appropriate, because so much of our relationship was centered there.
The 90s on.
Yeah.
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 Right. Very well.
But, and there, the other... longer term I was surprised last night to find out that there is another novel, and that there's because I vaguely remember there being something else that Ed was working on. I saw a manuscript copy of the Thin Air Gang as it progressed, mm-hmm. but I didn't remember ever seeing the other one, and I can't even put a date on it when he would have been working on that.
I don't either. But Rick DeMarinis, you know, Rick has moved out to Washington now. He lives up in Washington. Yeah. And so I've had some contact with him via, like, email and the mail. And I talked to him and asked him if he would be, if we could do something maybe over the phone, possibly, or whatnot. And he said he would probably write something. Yeah, which he said, I'm much better at that anyway, and give me a chance to think. So I'll put my head toward that. He's still writing, of course. So I'm sure that one of these days I'm going to receive this big, rather lengthy sort of memoir, recollections of his relationship with Ed, and so some of that could be cleared up.
Yeah.
Because he would know those things.
Right, right. Well, one of the things I did earlier this morning, and kind of was kind of out of curiosity, but also to be a little better prepared for this conversation, I went back through, I don't have everything on my hard drive, but I went back through writings that go back to 1989 and started searching for Ed and excerpting stuff. And I found a number of, again, poems in progress, but one of them that we actually discuss in the correspondence a lot was something I was working on entitled The Gospel in a Pill. And it had to do, Ed and I had lengthy discussions about depression. And that's part of what I think I was moving away from, especially after I met Kristen and my life had such a positive sense of direction. I think a lot of our relation, Ed and mine, was a kindred spirit in depression.
The dark.
The dark. Yeah. And so this gospel pill thing that I came across was interesting because it was triggered by a book that was called The Good News About Depression. And that was a book about this new medication. And that was, I don't know, remember even what the medication was, but that was in, it was in the, that was in the early to mid 90s. And so we would exchange these tidbits back and forth, and reading the stuff today, it made me feel really uneasy to return, because of what I was writing then, to return to that. And I stayed with it, but it really did make me aware that my life, especially the life there in Rumsey, was very reclusive, very introverted. And Ed, and that was the best there was. I mean, I really looked forward to those journeys to go and visit with him, and
at the same time he fed that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's I have that similar sort of connection with him, because I have an affinity for the darkness, and of course he fed that.
Yeah.
And so we would feed off of that.
Yeah. You know, so. Yeah. It was definitely uncomfortable for me to see those and read.
You want to take a break here for just a second?
Or we can wind it up if you're good with it.
If you think you're good, we've covered a lot of ground.
I'm very good with it. Yeah. I'm surprised Kristen's back.
Well, I'll end it. We're done with this thing. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Mark.